If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. With me today is Issa Bloomy. Issa is an associate professor in the Department of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Stockholm University. He is a historian, and he is the author of multiple books, the most recent of which is Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. Issa, good afternoon to you where you are. I almost said good evening, but you are in the Western Hemisphere, in Chile, to be exact. How are you, brother?
I'm tired, but good to be here in the midst of protests. There's military processions and about 10 people with signs demanding that the pesos be spent a little bit more wisely, getting in their way. It's a little interesting, but the numbers are not, of protests are not overwhelming, unfortunately.
So Chile, I've learned, has the largest and one of the oldest Palestinian communities outside of West Asia, about 400,000 to 500,000 Palestinians, depending on which source you consult. Have you seen any action on the ground there with regard to protests, with the war on occupied Palestine? What's your sense overall of what the people in Chile, the Palestinian community, and people outside of that, how they're responding to what's been happening since October 7th?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's the more general impression I get as I fly around the world is that the rest of the world have other things to worry about. And I'm afraid that's the case even here in Chile. There's big problems with depreciation of the currency, poverty, a lot of migrants. I was walking past the processing building for registration of foreigners, and it was just went around the block, and they were mostly people of African, and I could hear them. They were speaking local African languages. So, yeah, Palestinian issue is, it's, I even looked in newspapers, it's not prominent. It's a small piece of much larger issues about crime against politicians and crime in general. The Palestinians here are well integrated. They're quite powerful. And unfortunately, they played the dubious role also of supporting Pinochet. And they were ardent conservatives, a religiously very conservative community. Not Muslim, by the way, but Christian. They have, I think the Argentina Palestinian community is much more active just by the very fact that they're well integrated into unions and they're mostly on their lower level of society. Here in Chile, they're the ones who benefited from the mining industry, the plundering of the natural resources in the 19th, early 20th century. And so I think they're kind of caught in between their political instincts and maybe any hope to salvage the homeland. They do have connections, you know, of people who have family who are in the West Bank, but they definitely don't like the political Islam aspect of the resistance these days. So I think, and the fact that PLO had long had alliances with the left, I think made them, being anti-communist as they are in the Cold War context, also having very divided loyalties. So it's an interesting, you can't assume things about being Palestinian necessarily means, I mean, there's politics, right? And right, that's certainly the case with Palestinians in general. But the larger observation, traveling through Colombia airport at least, and then through some of the lounges in Europe as I was connecting with flights, is that money, the issue of bombing Gaza and the potential of the war expanding to Lebanon and perhaps even further, does ignite speculative side of the oil gas markets. So people are making business along those lines. Whenever it's over $90 now, so there's money to be made. But in terms of the politics and the ugly, nasty, genocidal violence of it, they're very quiet. Many countries have taken the position where if you stand up and actually say something on behalf of Palestinian people, you're immediately going to be labeled as a supporter of terrorism, and you will either be arrested or you could lose your job in some cases. So people have been fired. So I think in general, there have been some photogenic large protests, but the general feeling in many layers of society is that there are other things we have to worry about, the other things that we're dealing with. And this could be a business opportunity if you're with the people in the business class lounge. But otherwise, Financial Times had one article about Netanyahu's criminality and how that could impact the future of business, if you will, with Israel, and as it struggles to find ways to pay the bills. A lot of things have been neglected already, even before the war on Gaza. There's always been a war on Gaza, but this recent outburst of mass murder. New York Times, I saw the international edition. It's every piece, every single line is about Israel, supporting Israel, about the evilness of Palestine. So they really are an outlier. The German papers also were very heavily covering this story with a very pro-Israeli slant. But again, I was expecting to see a lot more solidarity. Nothing on the streets. Nothing spray painted. No old posters rallying people to come and, you know, show solidarity, at least in Chile and in Bogota, the brief moment I was there. So we'll see in Argentina now. But they just had an elections, and many are complaining about the elections have been stolen. So the old Peronists have suddenly regained a comfortable lead over this IMF-backed weirdo who's been waving
Mr.
around.
Mr. Chainsaw.
So that's I think that's probably the moral of the story, is that the rest of the world, if there is going to be discussions, there's going to be at the business level, they're going to be speculating on prices of certain commodities, how that will impact. Certainly the military industry is, I can already see ratcheting up the advertising in their own circles of where they usually advertise. UAE is making business deals left and right. They're bragging about their presence in Colombia, and bragging about their presence making oil and gas deals while all this is happening, doing their best to keep the story of property prices going up, even though I think they're being impacted immediately. People are getting a little nervous. And they should, because at some point, the countries like Jordan, Egypt, and those who have been on the sidelines and even quietly supporting Israel are vulnerable. And they have to be made much more vulnerable for this struggle to really go in the right direction. And that's my very big concern, is that as for the last 70 years, it is something that's just, it's now normal to hear stories of dead Palestinians or Palestinian children being tortured. And if it means 3 weeks of blowing up buildings, it seems it's really not driving people insane with anger in the rest of the world. And this is my concern, is that it's going to be forgotten very soon unless something radical happens. And the slow dying will they'll cut more veins, which is what they're doing now. More and more people are being eviscerated by these bombs. And yeah, people are talking about war expanding to, with Hezbollah at least. They're making every effort to remind that the Americans are, if the war does expand, they'll blame Iran for it. So you're already hearing talk about that. But that in itself creates new responses from the markets, right? People are now speculating on all this. So taking advantage of it, if you will. But that doesn't bode well for a country that's trying to encourage tourism, right? So already you hear canceled flights to Dubai just because of what they hear is happening in Gaza. Obviously, Egypt is suffering from all this. That's, if I can just bring just very briefly back my own experiences with Kosovo, because I think this is an important point about this concern that all this violence is normal again. The oldest running occupation regime that in the 20th century before 2007 was not Palestine, it was Kosovo. Kosovo was very much in the same boat. Kosovo Albanians were vilified, ignored, considered unimportant until the late 1990s, in large part because of what happened in neighboring Albania, when able-bodied men who could not defend themselves suddenly got hand of Kalashnikovs, an anti-tank weapon, which is what happened when Albania collapsed. And they were able to go into the military bases and you could buy Kalashnikov for 10, 15 German, the equivalent of $15, $20 in German mark. If something were to happen in Egypt, if something were to happen in Jordan, and that those regimes either fall or some elements of their military, composed in large part of Palestinians in the Jordan case, in Egypt, soldiers they despise the generals who are making a mess of their lives. And we saw one soldier kill 9 Israeli tourists, I think the first or second day, October 8th or October 9th, right? And there's no reason not to believe if this just keeps dragging on that the other elements in these two societies, armies, may initiate something that we can't anticipate. And if that results in actually getting West Bank armed far more than they are armed now, if the Jordan's army's resources actually fall into the hands, or if even the PA's resources fall into the hands of people willing to use it, that changes a lot of things. And I'm not going to say on public what should be done, but I'm just making the observation that that changed everything for us in Kosovo. We had to be taken seriously, and suddenly demonstrating that we can use those weapons and actually turn the tables, if you will, on the ground, make things that much more complicated, suddenly got the Americans to think differently about what's going on. And then the implicit threat that this war will expand, and that was a very big possibility in the Balkans, to spread it in the neighboring countries. And if it spreads in a way in the Middle East, that is not something that these guys in Pentagon elsewhere actually have been thinking about or know that if it does, it's big problems, then things can change. My concern is that Palestinians are going to be, who have been marginalized for a long time, their political leadership have been complicit at least since Oslo. Unfortunately, even Hamas, those who are in the back pocket of Qatar, they have served very many different roles, not necessarily ones that would have unified the world behind them. It is possible that we could see tens of thousands of more Palestinians die, with the entirety of Gaza being on the verge of either starving to death and having to, in large scale, move them somewhere else. They've been pushing for Sinai, and my suspicion is that if indeed they get people out of North Gaza, that will be the interim. There will be a period for a while they'll be all packed in southern Gaza, and the oil and gas contracts could be signed then for the north because it's de facto annexation. The time, I mean, you can see it, the third world is not going to go take that extra step for Palestinians. Palestinians are going to have to change things on the ground to force the big guys to actually change their policy. I mean, Ronald Reagan in the 1980s made a very harsh phone call to the right, the radicals in Israel, saying, "You guys are making a mess of Lebanon. You're making a mess of our Middle East. you need to stop now. And this is, I think, we have to return that equation to the table. And unfortunately, for a long time now, even with the Islamic Jihad and Hamas, they have, in many ways, willingly or not, served a role for the likes of Netanyahu to make political campaigns out of them. So, and that's my concern now, Jesse. Sorry to babble on.
No. Thank you for that. There are so many complexities, countless complexities in what's been happening, including with the Palestinian resistance factions themselves. These are not pure factions. They are compromised in a number of ways, and it's important to point that out, but also important to point out simultaneously that there is legitimate Palestinian resistance to occupation, to expulsion, to genocide. There are many contingencies, seen and unseen, at play here. And underneath all of that, once again, there is a legitimate grassroots, if you will, of Palestinian resistance, a Palestinian movement for liberation. And to just look at the factions, to just look at Hamas, to just look at the PIJ, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, is a mistake. And also to think that everyone within those factions is towing the same line is a mistake as well. It's much more complex than the picture painted, even by the likes of Al Jazeera. So important to keep that in mind, and also important to bring up with regard to the expulsion. There's been a lot of talk about the Sinai, but a remark made by Sisi when he held a press conference with Olaf Scholz last week went largely unacknowledged, at least in my research. And this was picked up. I saw Sisi say this live on Al Jazeera when they covered the press conference with Scholz. This was picked up by a number of media outlets and also mentioned in passing. And Reuters picked it up on October 18th. And here's the excerpt from the Reuters article. Egypt has been alarmed at the idea that Israel's unprecedented bombardment and siege of Gaza, home to 2.3 million people, could force its residents southwards into Sinai. The Gaza Strip is effectively under Israeli control, and Palestinians could instead be moved to Israel's Negev Desert, quote, till the militants are dealt with, unquote, Sisi told a joint press conference in Cairo with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Now, I don't know if that was an off-the-cuff comment in passing, but that reads to me like Sisi saying, well, as long as the Palestinians aren't expelled to Egypt and the Sinai, as long as the Sinai doesn't become a base for the resistance, then we're fine with, possibly fine with, expulsion elsewhere to the Negev Desert, for example. And again, this comment, whether in passing, off the cuff, or whether it's hinting at something more behind the scenes, I can't say, but I think it's important to keep in mind, and I'm curious if you have anything to say about this.
Well, if we buy the whole narrative that Hamas and Islamic Jihad, along with Fatah, are enemies number one for Israel, and enemies number one times two for, in respect to Hamas and all Muslim Brotherhood affiliates, with Egypt sharing similar hostilities. We know that the Sisi represents a cadre of elements in the Egyptian military, industrial complex that for decades have suppressed Muslim Brotherhood affiliates in Egypt. The whole events since 2011 up until Morsi's removal was a war between that element and the Muslim Brotherhood inside Egypt. The hostilities that extended to Qatar, Turkey, because of their support of Muslim Brotherhood elements in Egypt, extended to their support to Hamas, who are coming from ideological, theological, as well as the pedigree of their human resources that they're drawing in, and their alliances they've made. So Sisi is not going to countenance, and they have been working hand in hand for a long time under this narrative. There's hostility. It extends to even the event, what's happening in Libya at the moment, right? So the Egyptians are supporting certain factions who are at war with the Turkish Qatari-backed faction. And that extends to Sisi's willingness to work in Syria with alongside Syrians. But that makes it all very complicated considering what are Egypt's primary role right now, the military elites who are now, until the events of October 7, facing big political issues with trying to garner enough money to pay the bills. Their ratings have consistently dropped, so the price to borrow money kept rising. That was the one that's scattered around the headlines everywhere in Egypt. Their issues with Ethiopia regarding the Nile River, that was an ongoing problem. The events, the ongoing war in Sudan, the war for ascendancy. So all these things were about play. And in the meantime, Sisi's government and Israel were coming to agreements for Egypt to import more Israeli gas, a lot of which, as we've discussed before, actually comes from Egyptian fields. But because these Egyptian fields are paying back debts to Israeli companies, it's basically being recycled through Israeli accounts. So Egypt has been using a lot of that money that it supposedly is borrowing from IMF to pay Israeli gas companies for gas that's coming from Egyptian fields. And so these are the kinds of relationship that Sisi has. So you can never expect Sisi to turn his back on that relationship. His very existence is predicated on him bringing a kind of stability to Egypt that avails the Israeli project, that allows for the Israeli project to expand. And that continues in the form of good relations in the Red Sea, the handing over of very important islands to at least allow Israeli intelligence to set up shop there to monitor traffic in the Red Sea. And this has been in collaboration with Jordan and Saudi Arabia, very quietly. That's been going on. Saudis have been supporting Sisi now for a long time, as have UAE. And that's all under the umbrella of these Abrahamic Accords, all the other things that we were seeing in media throughout 2023. Egypt is front and center. Egypt provides that kind of legitimate Arab, that non-Gulf Arab kind of presence in these meetings that are then marketed to international community. No one buys it, but nevertheless, it is something that's forefronted in how we talk about these things. So don't expect.
For example, the summit that was held a few days ago in Cairo, at which many so-called dignitaries were present, Arab dignitaries, Western dignitaries, and it was just a salon, a geopolitical salon to talk and exchange ideas, and got nothing done. There was no statement issued, no plan of action. And this speaks to not just how Egypt is helping the Israeli project expand, but also how the so-called international community is helping that along as well. So you get statements like this from Sisi with regard to potential expulsion to the Negev of Palestinians. And then you get China For example, China's foreign minister Wang Yi, ahead of his visit to the U.S. this week, now affirming Israel's right to self-defense, shifting his stance, according to Bloomberg. And what's interesting about this, just a minor point, but what's interesting is that the original headline for this article was China affirms Israel's right to self-defense, comma, shifting stance. And then it was updated a few hours later. So now if you go to Bloomberg, the URL is the same with that title, but the new headline reads, China repeats view that Israel must protect civilians. I don't know what was behind that change, but the point is...
By the way.
Right, right. Well, in China's case, it's all civilians because Beijing supposedly cares about everybody. That's their MO. So, and then we see huge failings. Nothing, no action, certainly, and no words of consequence being issued by the Arab regimes, whether we're talking about Saudi, whether we're talking about the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Oman, nothing of substance, nothing even that could be called inflammatory or antagonistic, and not just for the sake of antagonism, but in impassioned defense of Palestinians, nothing coming from them. And the same can be said, obviously, about China, as I just pointed out. And the same can be said about Russia and the UN Security Council, where it's become a spectacle of political dunking on one another. So who can dunk on whom with these draft resolutions that keep getting vetoed and have these ridiculous clauses in them and just shift the focus entirely away from the genocide that is happening on the ground in Gaza and also in the West Bank, which doesn't get talked about a lot. Nearly 100 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since October 7th, and thousands have been essentially kidnapped by Zionist occupation forces, in addition to the thousands that are already imprisoned there, some who've been imprisoned and held without charge for decades. So,
Go ahead. Syrian airports are regularly being bombed with corresponding human deaths. Southern Lebanon has been bombed regularly. We don't know how many civilians have been killed, let alone those who are legitimately fighting. Not only what's because of Gaza and Palestine, but because there are settlements inside Lebanese territories, we forget, which are being targeted. The lists go on, but with, again, no reference other than the concerns of the war spreading and then issuing warnings to Tehran as if their fingers are on the actual control mechanisms for what's going on here. And that's the concern, is that we've moved far, far away from what is the fundamental reason behind all of this. And that's this tactic, of course, right? And in the meantime, as everyone calls for ceasefire and everyone starts debating again the viability of a two-state solution, which ends up consuming another 48 hours of everyone's attention, another 1,000 people have been blown to pieces. More infrastructure in Gaza has been destroyed. And probably if we start looking at it, a pattern. Most likely there's a pattern to the bombing. I mean, if you look at how certain parts of the developed areas are very untouched and then whole kind of pathways have been blown to dust. I mean, just to dust. There is not even big sides of walls of these buildings that were sometimes 10 stories high. Literally, they're all dust. So what kind of pulverized, what kind of bombs they were using, right, which no one wants to discuss, giving no chance for survival of the people who are hiding it underneath. I mean, this is what Israelis perfected in Lebanon, is this bombs that penetrate the building, go all the way down to the bottom, and then explode at the bottom, deep right where the garages are, where the stores are at the first floor, to bring it all down and just pulverize everything, as you said. It's just
And you used to live down the street. You used to live down the street from a building that was hit by such ordnance.
And it caused so much trauma in the neighborhood that no one has gone there. No one's touched that place. It must have been a horrible, horrible thing. The hole is still there in the middle of a developed area. And again, no one has touched it. Maybe because of property disputes, whatever. But no one wanted to touch this. It's just filled up with garbage. And so this is what's happened to Gaza, not only 2023. It's happened over a regular period of time over the last 20, 30 years. So that this also is quite frustrating, is that we always end up seeming to say that everything starts with October 7th, which suits a lot of people just fine. And this is the other big pet peeve I have with all the solidarity expressed as possibly we can, is that, you know, we suffer the consequences of our failing to find solidarity in other people's struggles. And there was not a word from the large group of people who are raising a voice publicly now. Not one word in solidarity for people of Yemen for years. And I don't want to bring myself into that, but people like me who were writing about what was happening in Yemen were not invited to these fora at CUNY, at University of California system campuses, to places in Europe. No one wanted to talk about it because the politics of this kind of, you know, the politics around violence in the Middle East has Gulf money insinuated throughout. So as I've said many times on your show, there were things you just could not mention when we talked about war in Yemen. And that extends to Democracy Now and other kind of channels that could possibly alert a kind of passive leftist audiences in the United States, at least, to what's going on in Yemen. Twice in my case, the producers explicitly took me off the guest list when I made it clear that I was going to bring Qatar up into the conversation. So my suspicion is that we are suffering the consequences of our inability to actually speak on principle throughout the Middle East to the horrors that have been visited upon the peoples of Yemen, of Sudan, of Libya. For goodness sake, why not even Congo? Why cannot people rise up and rally behind the people who are struggling for dignity in Papua New Guinea or in Irian Jaya or in Haiti? Why are we all compartmentalized? And why is it only now that so many of the people who are supposedly experts in the Middle East, who have some self-definition leftist elements to them, are now actually actively involved in condemning violence against innocent people? When there were so many plenty of opportunities over the last 20 years, no one brings in what happened to Syria and how that country was targeted for destruction, as it's happened, right? I mean, just, it really does tie into that huge divide separating those who wanted to stand up on behalf of justice and just humanity in Syria and those who took a very partisan view and said that the regime has to go, kind of looking the other way who were actually involved in it. And unfortunately, those who were involved...
Or vice versa, Assad can do no wrong.
Or Assad can do no wrong. But you could see it actually playing itself out in the partisanship in the Palestinian story as well, which has not served Palestinians very well, right, has it? When you literally had people taking sides on this kind of ideological scale that in the end boils down to whose money is actually supporting your faction. Is it Qatari money? Is it Saudi money? Or coming from somewhere else? And that is... what has happened to the Middle East story? It's been poisoned for 20, 30 years now. You do not get a PhD in studying the Middle East unless you have some money behind it. And you're either consciously or unconsciously know that there's no-go zones. There are third rails in your discourse. And if you want a job at Ivy League or if you want a job at a think tank, you better know where that money is coming from, because otherwise you're not going to get it. And that it has huge impact on Palestine, as it obviously did in Sudan and Yemen and Eritrea and Libya and Syria and Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. And sadly, Turkey as well. A lot of Turks have just kept their mouths shut because it's now not clear what your position should be, because it's not clear what Ankara's position is. You know, they have very conflicted relations with Azerbaijan, which is the primary beneficiary of Israeli intelligence for the last 20, 30 years. Azerbaijan flies the Star of David and weaponry for a decade. I mean, we know that Turkey also benefits from these close relations with Israel. And yet they've played for 20 years or so in the context of the Syrian war as the primary and the only responsible actors, tough guys in the region willing to stand up for Palestinians. No, they played along the divide that exists in Palestine, in large part because of outsiders. And I know for a fact most Palestinians don't see it that way, but it plays itself out, unfortunately, with how international community actually operates on the Palestinian story. And especially in conditions of this trickling, this daily death of 1, 2, 5 people, not the big spectacular events like that happens every 5 years where thousands die, but the one that happens every day, and really everyone ignores it and doesn't really talk about it. And that's where I'm concerned that it's going to happen again. It's already happening at so many levels in the larger world who have other things, again, to be worried about. That does not bode well for the people of Gaza or the West Bank or the diaspora, who look painfully at and feel that the world is not going to intervene on their behalf. And there's no hero, there's no Superman, no Captain Palestine coming to save them.
Right. Well, to that point, a few nights ago, or a few mornings ago, I should say, Al Jazeera interviewed an activist in Gaza, a Palestinian named Mansour Shuman. And he was emphatic in this interview that we are alone. The UN Security Council is not with us. The WHO is not with us. Other parts of the UN are not with us. The Arab world is not with us. We are entirely alone. And to paraphrase his words, God will see us through this along with our own wherewithal. And he's not the only one I've witnessed saying that. And he didn't explicitly call out the Arab regimes, but it was implicit in what he was saying. And that includes Qatar as well, which of course is the benefactor of Al Jazeera. And Qatar has seemingly been more concerned with LNG, 27-year LNG supply deals it's been signing with the likes of Shell to provide LNG from Qatar to the Netherlands to provide LNG to Europe. That was about 5 days ago that was signed. And in the past day, Qatar Energy, the same entity, signed a similar 27-year LNG supply agreement with Eni, the Italian giant. So that seems to be top of mind for them, at the forefront for them. And then when it comes to the UAE, we have the Safin Group signing a strategic MOU to collaborate on maritime and shipping sector in Azerbaijan with SOCAR, which is the state oil apparatus in Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan, again, being a close ally of the Zionist occupation entity, receiving intelligence and weaponry from them, was loading up on both just before the nearly complete cleansing of Artsakh. And Safin Group is a primary entity in terms of the UAE and the AD Ports Group, which I know is something that you want to talk about. So while we have this genocide continuing in Gaza and these actors who in the UN were supposed to herald because they're standing with Russia or acting with Russia to put forth some sort of diplomatic stopgap with humanitarian pauses or whatever, this meaningless language that really affects nothing on the ground insofar as I can see. Well, we're supposed to herald these entities like the UAE, like Qatar. Here you have the UAE brokering deals or at least signing MOUs with a key ally of the Zionist occupation entity. And the same can be said about Iran, which recently broke ground with Azerbaijan for a new trade and transport corridor. So many out there, I am sure, might not like this being pointed out, but it needs to be pointed out. The complicity with the Israeli project that is genociding Palestinians and where the concerns for these Arab regimes and Iran and other entities of the so-called multipolar resistance, where their concerns really lie and how serious they are in the words they offer up in terms of supporting Palestinian resistance and liberation.
Well, if we remember what the colonization of Palestine's initial function, or at least let's say from the late 19th century onwards, its strategic location, where it was already understood to be pressure points for global transport, so the Suez Canal opening, but also recognizing that there was going to be exported oil from at least Kirkuk, if not the Baku Caspian Sea region, that needed access to the Mediterranean, which would be then the veiling for the markets that would be consuming this petroleum products in the beginning of the 20th century. So that was one of the very functions. If you look at the map and how countries are designed in the Middle East, it's all predicated on availing pipelines, creating pipeline corridors to Haifa, to Jaffa, and the importation of large numbers of especially armed, well-armed and trained Haganah types who ended up being partners with the British, despite the fact that they would turn their guns on the British at some point as well, to eliminate organized labor who were able to stop the flow of Kirkuk oil to the Mediterranean in the in the early to mid-1930s. If we just remember that, we just then look at all these deals. Now it's liquefied natural gas. Obviously, the technology's changed. Liquefied natural gas, you still need shipping lanes to remain open. You need facilities to process the liquefied natural gas. The UAE is offering to build some of that infrastructure with significant contracts to their companies. The Chinese have offered to do that in their Beltway initiatives, which are, by the way, not looking very well for the countries like Pakistan or Kenya, which it connects to some extent to what the UAE is up to now, trying to exploit this now, this momentary refocus on this strategic side of guaranteeing supply chains. Russia-Ukraine war created that momentary blip, but allowed for a lot of business deals to happen again. And at this time, I suspect there's a lot of contracts being signed with the pricing and the insurance prices, all these things taken into consideration with the possibility that war breaks out. And possibility of war breaking out in the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, if indeed we hear the Grahams of South Carolina, Netanyahu, in October 7th, said Iran had a hand in this attack on us. That maybe this is an opportunity for Iran to be violently integrated back into the fold. So it's happening with China's Beltway initiatives, which again has seen big financing issues over the last year. I talked about in respect to Angola, how Angola is actually actively looking for alternatives. They got a consortium of Belgium and Portuguese companies to come and take over the building of railroads, the cobalt and copper zones of Zambia and DRC. Now, and apparently American companies have been organizing credit for that same line that goes to Lobito, which is south of Luanda. And that would be a viable alternative to Mombasa, Dar es Salaam, Mogadishu, Kinshasa, and northern Mozambique, which was being set up for the last 10, 15 years by Chinese construction companies as the logical place to bring Central African cobalt and other raw materials to the coast and then to larger markets. So what's happening is that there's been a shift that actually things, the flow of that, those horrible products that we need for our green revolution to happen and be sustained, can actually take to the West Coast because of the infrastructure that's being on offer now. And it's almost done, this Lobito line. So there's a lot of celebration of that. In certain quarters, especially in the Lusophone world, which is, I think, now that UAE is rapidly filling in some gaps and trying to sustain Dar es Salaam as a viable port, which could be easily lost out to the fact, or now is taking advantage of the fact that Kenyan infrastructure is now heavily in debt, and they've stopped all their projects for railroads to connect with Uganda. The Mombasa expansion, the Mombasa port is now on hold because, again, financing is not there. So there's maybe a window of opportunity to exploit. There's all the new discussions about Ethiopia gaining access through Eritrea for ports, which in a Saab case, that's where the UAE is based, its military forces vis-a-vis fighting the war in Yemen. We talked about already Ethiopia and Djibouti with the Chinese line that they resurrected from the old Italian one. So these kinds of crises, like the one that affects the quintessential strategic zone for the oil and global transport infrastructure, the East Mediterranean, in which Palestine is right in the middle of it. The fact that war has and the instability has again returned to this region, even if it's something that's temporary. It is something that alerts and ignites numbers. It starts to alert desks to get into operation. There's speculation now that's happening. So you're seeing now the separation of prices from yesterday's prices to tomorrow's possible prices. And so people are making money off of that. And that's enough money to actually start initiating these strategic alliances. And again, they were not feasible 6 months ago, 3 weeks ago even. And in the meantime, those projects to deliver Israeli gas and oil, refined oil, to Egypt is not possible because its refinery just north of Gaza is shut down because of the possible missile strikes, and that it actually has no capacity other than in its very small infrastructure in the Red Sea, in its Red Sea port, to actually refine oil. So now it's going to be facing having to import refined oil from, lo and behold, what do you think? So Azerbaijan, through Turkish conduits, all kinds of things are playing itself out now as this war. And I'm pretty sure that some people in Netanyahu circles are actually making pretty big money off of this because they knew ahead of time, or they're able to anticipate where they can create crisis next. And that takes me finally back to this observation made with this interview on Al Jazeera, that Palestinians know they're alone. They can't rely on. That's been the case for a long time in many ways. But again, I bring back the example that we had in the Balkans. If we want to change things, we actually have to change things. And we cannot have regimes in areas that help contain Palestine into being basically a shootout, like shooting apples in a barrel. I don't know these phrases that people have in English, but I mean, Jordan and Egypt play and the Gulf play an important role in containing the Palestinian story for now 30 years, since at least Black September, if not at least Oslo, if not Black September. Neighboring countries have suppressed violently sometimes Palestinian ability to organize, to arm themselves, and to lash out. And so they've been pushed into Syria, into Lebanon, and we see that translate into a disaster during the course of the 1980s and early 1990s for Palestinians and for Lebanese people and Syrians. So again, if Palestinians recognize that they're alone, they're going to be basically murdered in increments of 5,000-10,000 every crisis, and then daily, you know, two or three people every day. And if they're not going to be able to change things, then things are not going to change for them. It's just going to be in ultimately 20, 30 years, no more Palestine. You can look on that damn map. Those maps are stunning. From 47 to today, there is basically nothing left of Palestinian inhabited, organized land anywhere. Gaza is going to be cut.
Which brings up this talk we hear regurgitated again and again from the so-called international community about a two-state solution. There's no possibility, given the geographical realities on the ground, of a two-state solution. So to me, that's an indicator of how serious Russia, China, the US, France, all of them are about creating a so-called viable Palestinian state, which is to say they're not serious at all because they're operating within the realm of fantasy. Look at a map, a current map of the West Bank and the areas that have been carved up thanks to Oslo, especially Area C. It makes a contiguous, so-called contiguous viable Palestinian state existing side by side in peace with Israel impossible. So what are these people talking about when they propose bringing the two-state solution back to the fore and working toward that? They're talking about a fantasy, and that to me indicates their lack of seriousness about diplomacy or whatever they're trying to do. And maybe it speaks to something beyond that. I don't know. I can only speculate. But to call for a two-state solution at this point, and then to say without anything to back it up that this is what most Palestinians want, is it's breathtaking to still be beholding this fantasy talk and inaction this day and age. But again, as we said several weeks ago, not surprising.
Well, and what's happened to Palestine has happened in the larger world. It's a diplomatic model that they've been using since the 19th century, where sectarianism, you know, confessional associations are the dividing lines of societies. Despite the fact that historically they've lived side by side, they've intermarried, they do business with each other. This is what many of the very principled Jews have long said, that Zionism and the Zionist project is a colonialist project par excellence, which has basically established a principle of division, dividing populations along religious lines. This is what the French did to Syria. This is what they've been doing to the Balkans for 150 years. This is what they're trying to do with the Caucasus, and indeed with any other part of the world that is, whether it be religious lines or racial lines. I mean, this is a strategy, a perfect strategy, which is, again, service empire for a long time. And it's not going to change unless we change those dynamics. And there's been plenty of arguments throughout the 1950s and 60s. Well, the Palestinian Arabs, and this is why we need to be very careful with our language. We can't just revert to them just calling them Arabs in Israeli conflict. It's not an Arab and Israeli conflict. Because when you do that, then why don't they just move to the east bank of the Jordan River? There's plenty of Arab territories for them to go, like the Sinai. Or why don't they send them to northern Sudan or something? So we have to remind everybody and constantly be very vigilant that this is Palestine we're talking about. We're not talking about them going to Negev Desert and then to Sinai or in diaspora. Palestine is home. It is for one country with multiple religious peoples. Jews, Christians, and Muslims must live together in one civic system. That's how it should have been from day one. And unfortunately, we keep falling for the trap of the rhetoric, the discourse established by empire. Thank you, Jesse, for your time. And hasta luego.
Thank you, Isa. Until next time, inshallah. Take care, brother.